Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Oh, here's our room. True crime.
You've entered the House of Mystery on WXEI, the talk of Crestview, Panama City, Pensacola, Florida, with your hosts Al Warren, Kev Thompson, and Julie Saffron, and The Conspiracy Countdown with Dr. Joe and Stephen David Lampley's Crime Commentary.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the House of Mystery. This is your host, Kevin Thompson, and sitting right seat is Rob. Say hello, Rob.
Hi, everyone.
And we are broadcasting out of WXEI, the talk of Clearwater, Florida. And joining us today is Michael Withy. Michael, say hello.
Hi, how's everybody doing?
Now, as for us, we're doing awesome here in Alabama.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Yeah. Anyways, we're here today to talk about summary execution, Seattle assassinations. And Michael, from what I'm told, you are the expert. But before we get deeply into that, tell us a little bit about Michael and, you know, tell us about your journey that brought us to this point.
Well, you know, I grew up in a family that really cared about people, cared about issues and movements and making sure that everyone's taken care of. And so when I went to law school, I decided in San Francisco in 68 to 71, I decided I wanted to be on the side of the little guy against the powerful interests and in the people who think they can get away with it. And I wanted to use the legal system as a tool for social change. Started a law collective here in Seattle with my brother-in-law and a lot of really good people. Everybody got paid the same. And in that process, I met two wonderful, wonderful human beings, Selmy Domingo and Jean Vernis. They were part of the Filipino community and also part of the anti-Marcos movement in the U.S. that I would go to the picket lines and demonstrations against the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines. And Gene and Selmy were union activists. They were part of a cannery workers union that organized 1,100 cannery workers in Alaska. If that's unheard enough, I don't know what is. So it was quite a heady time back in the 70s, and Gene and Selmy brought me in as the union lawyer. We'd go up and do organizing drives up in Alaska in the summer. And so that was kind of, we were also part of a broader movement in the 70s and early 80s. Reagan came in and promised a lot of really bad things happening. And so I was part of the effort to try to resist the cutbacks, et cetera. So I was really a political activist that decided I wanted to do law. And I was involved in a lot of kind of movement type cases in the 70s and 80s, and then the murders happened and completely, you know, changed my life.
Now, you mentioned murders. What murders were these?
Well, on June 1st, 1981, Sony and Gene were working in the local 37 Camry Union Hall, which was part of the International Longshore and Warehousing Union in Seattle. And two hitmen, Jimmy Ramil, the trigger man, and Ben Galloy, who was kind of a decoy, at 4 o'clock, 4:20 in the afternoon. They were the only ones in the union office. They burst into the union, and Ramil pulled a MAC-10 45 caliber execution piece out of a brown paper bag with a suppressor on it, aimed it at Gene, shot twice. Gene died instantly. Oh. And then shot Selmy 4 times in a swivel chair. And then they exited and went down the alley. And then a lookout, a guy named Boy Pili, meaning cripple in Tagalog, ran across the street into a quote-unquote getaway car, a black Trans Am, driven by Tony Dictato, who was a union. He was the head of the gang. It was called the Tulasan Gang that these guys were all members of. So believe it or not, Selmy, with 4 45 caliber bullet holes in his stomach, just tore his stomach up, chases the hitman out of the union hall, collapses on the sidewalk, bleeding out, and the fireman hears him screaming and comes, the first responder responded and asked Selmy who shot him, and Selmy said very clearly, Jimmy Ramil and Ben Gloy, he knew them. And that basically started a murder investigation, followed by a civil lawsuit that that we brought, resulting in an amazing victory that I write about in my book, Summary Execution, a victory that held Ferdinand Marcos. We proved 10 years later Ferdinand Marcos had these guys killed, and it's the first and only time a foreign leader's ever been held liable for the murder of U.S. citizens on U.S. soil. And we won a $15.1 million jury verdict, and as well as a judge trial. So, but it took us years and years to pursue justice, and there was a lot of twists and turns, a lot of obstacles that we had to face.
Yeah, but that's absolutely understandable. I mean, here you have, like you said, a foreign dictator, for lack of better terms, who was actually attempting to manipulate local politics, if I'm understanding what you're saying, local politics.
Correct.
In your area. Now, unless I'm mistaken, you're implying that he was actually using a local gang to act as his hands.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, it took years to prove this, but what happened was that the Ramil and Galoy were immediately arrested, and there was a trial of the hitmen. And in the trial of the hitman, you guys aren't going to believe this, in the trial of the hitman, a mystery witness came forward to testify for the defense that he was at, this middle-aged guy, white guy, and he said, I was at the phone booth across, they used to have phone booths, right? They had a phone booth across the street. This is 81, okay? And there, he said he observed the whole thing. He said a guy went into the union hall, came back, running out with something underneath of his arm, got into the green Trans Am and drove away. He walked across the street and said, what happened? What happened? Because the guy was screaming and yelling. And he asked him, who shot you? And the man who was injured, who was Selmy Domingo, said, I don't know. And we were going, what in the world? Who is this guy? So the jury kind of didn't believe him and convicted Ramil and Galoy anyway. But then we took the guy's deposition. His name was Levain Forsyth. And turns out that Forsyth was an informant for the FBI, whose modus operandi, we found out, was to be told to go to a stand in a particular location, go to a restaurant, go to a park, whatever, observe what happened and write a report, which is exactly what he did in this case. So we knew then, because this guy appeared trying to exonerate the hitman, we knew then that some very powerful interests. This was not a local kind of gang shooting, hot-headed Filipinos shooting it up in the union hall, right? Mm-hmm. This was like, whoa, the FBI knew about this thing. What? You know, he didn't just happen to be there, right? So that causes a lot of suspicion, and so we started investigating. And found out that we did a Freedom of Information Act against the FBI and the Naval Investigative Service out of Alameda County Air Station, because both of these organizations had infiltrated the Union of Democratic Filipinos. That was an anti-Marcos organization that Gene and Selmy were labor leaders of. They were, high-ranking members of this very militant, very prominent anti-Marcos group in the U.S., and they had ties in the Philippines. Well, Gene, 2 months before he was killed, had traveled to the Philippines and met with the leaders of the large anti-Marcos labor federations. Marcos was having trouble with his rule because he had the New People's Army, the guerrillas in the countryside, and then he had the labor movement in the cities. And so we believe that Gene had been surveilled at the meetings with the head of the unions, the federation, and then he and Selmy Domingo go to the international convention of their union, which is the Longshore Union. The Longshore Union on the West Coast loads and unloads all the commodities go to and from the Philippines. It's a hugely important union to the Filipino community and Hawaii in particular. And guess what? They engineered the passage of a resolution that dispatched an ILWU investigative team to go to the Philippines that they would have led. They would have been on it to go to the Philippines and investigate the deplorable treatment. I mean, people were getting shot at picket lines. There wasn't any right to strike. The unions in the Philippines were really in bad shape, were really under a lot of heat. So these two guys engineered this passage of this great resolution, and a month later they're murdered. Well, how in the world are we going to figure out, well, how? So what does that have to do with the murders in Seattle, right? So guess what happens? Marcos decides he's going to kill the leading opponent to his regime, which is Benigno Aquino. When he gets off the airplane, I don't know if you guys remember this, in 1983, the leading moderate opposition to Marcos decides he's going to go back to the Philippines and run against him. Well, that didn't last long. He set foot on Philippine soil off the plane and got gunned down by Marcos's military, the same people who killed Gene and Selmy. Well, Marcos gets overthrown because his wife, Cory Aquino, takes up the People's Power Revolution and overthrows Marcos. So Marcos flees to the United States after being told he had to leave the Philippines by the Reagan administration through the then-governor, Paul Laxalt, in Nevada. Mm-hmm. So guess what? When he gets onto to U.S. soil, we slap a subpoena on him in our lawsuit because we had sued originally had sued Marcos and the Philippine government.
Well, excuse me for interrupting, but I'm just curious. How do you feel about the current government in the Philippines with Rodrigo Duterte? I mean, isn't he just as bad?
Oh, yeah, he's terrible. I mean, he's one of the chronic human rights violators of all time. Guess what? His national security advisor, his national security advisor was a Marcos spy in the U.S. between 1978 and 1982, and Esparon, his name is. But at any rate, yeah, Duterte, that's why I call the book Summary Execution, because that's what Duterte is doing. He's killing, it's not just drug dealers and drug users, they're basically poor people, and now he's going after his opponents.
I was going to ask you, didn't he recently take control back from the police because they were going a little too far with it?
Who, Duterte?
Yeah.
In Davao City, he had some 3,000 plus people were summarily executed. No arrests, no trials, no jury, no judge or anything. They just off them, just kill them all.
Oh, right.
But what's important about...
It was going on a lot, but I mean, I heard recently that he had tried to scale it back, get it more under his personal control, but it was the police were just taking it a little too far.
That might be true, but he started the whole thing.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's his plan for how to deal with the drug problem is kill everybody.
And
that's Duterte's policy.
Were you afraid at all during all of this? I mean, after all, you're deeply involved in it personally and professionally, basically. So, were you not afraid they might turn on you and go after you too?
Good.
Well, sure. The Seattle Police Department told us we had to wear bulletproof vests and carry a firearm for our personal safety, and believe me, I did. I was in the Army. I could shoot a .45. I had a .45, and we wore bulletproof vests for the first 6 months until three of the gang members were convicted. But you ask about how do we link the Marcos regime to the gang?
Yes.
When Marcos fled the Philippines for the U.S., we subpoenaed his records and in his financial records, because he had stolen like $30 billion from the Filipino people, and he wanted to know where in the world all of his money was. So he brought his financial records. There was a two-page document. There was an itemization of expenditures out of the Mabuhay Corporation, which was used as an intelligence slush fund. And it had payments to illegal campaign contributions to Ronald Reagan. It had a lot. They were buying radio stations and propaganda vehicles. This was an attack by the Marcos regime on our country, but particularly on the anti-Marcos groups here. Well, on May 17th, there was an expenditure out of this intelligence slush fund called a special security project of $15,000. That's the day where the guy who provided the gun and the money for the hit flew to San Francisco, met with a lieutenant colonel in Marcos's military, flew back, provided his gun, the MAC-10 45 caliber execution piece, to the hitmen and paid them for the hit. We proved this in court, and a federal judge ruled and the jury ruled that that was the instrument that was used, that was the intelligence slush fund used to pay for the murders through Marcos. So Marcos' money hired the hit team, and the gun was a Marcos ally guy named Tony Barroso. And Tony Barroso wasn't even charged by the local prosecutor until we proved our case against Marcos 10 years later. Then he was charged and convicted of murder.
Well, Mike, this almost sounds, from what you're describing, connecting the weapons to somebody almost sounds like Fast and Furious. Would that be
I'm not sure of the illusion. There's no cars involved, except for a Trans Am, I guess.
Oh, no, where you're able to actually connect the weapon to a leader. Now, let's back up just a little bit, because I want to clarify this for the listeners. Are you saying, from our earlier discussion, that the FBI knew about all of this? And if that's true, how much resistance did you run up against in your investigation?
Huge resistance. In fact, it's still going on. Tomorrow, we're going to go to the FBI office and say, let me back up. So we take the FBI informant's deposition, but the judge said, look, I don't want to hear anything about the U.S. government. I want to hear, I'll let you try your case against Marcos. Judge Rothstein was a great judge, and she allowed us to try a case against Marcos, and we won that case. So when I'm researching this book 30 years later, I bring a Freedom of Information Act against the FBI saying, give us everything you have on this guy, Forsythe. That was the name of the FBI informant, because he had testified he had been an informant out of Los Angeles, out of Southern California, for an IRS, DEA, FBI task force into money laundering and drug use. And that, and he said, you know, he had nothing to do with the Seattle FBI, according to him. Well, guess what? We brought this Freedom of Information Act in June of 2015, almost 3 years ago. And the FBI has now been forced to admit it has 1,276 pages on the use of this informant out of the Seattle office of the FBI. So we're going to go in tomorrow, and we're going to say, look, I'm here to report a crime. The FBI has obstructed justice by sending their FBI informant to watch this murder happen and then to testify to try to exonerate the hitman, the Marcos paid hitman. And so we haven't got a single page of that. And they said, well, the name of his control agent is personal privacy. And I said, well, wait a minute. You don't even know if the guy's alive. You're not getting his name. I said, I tell you what, I'll send you the name of the 42 FBI agents in the Seattle office of the FBI. We had their names because they were involved in the investigation of the murders. You think that went anywhere? They worked on this case for a year, and the FBI never brought any charges.
Mike, I'm a little and they hasty
said,
about
I said, all you have to do is – I'm sorry,
oh,
Ben.
I'm sorry. I was going to ask you. I'm a little hazy about this mystery witness, as you refer to him. He's an informant for the FBI. Did he just happen to be across the street, which seems highly coincidental, or was he placed there, or was
– No. He was put there.
He was put there knowing this was going to happen?
Yes.
Wow, that's amazing.
So he's a plant.
He's a plant.
A false
listen,
witness.
Listen, let me tell you what the guy testified to. He testified that he was close with the Hughes Empire. He used to work for Howard Hughes. His son still works for a Hughes company. You remember Howard Hughes, the guy that he's like the Koch brothers of the 1960s and 70s, right? He ran Las Vegas with Paul Laxalt, and his lieutenant was Robert Mayhew. I know this sounds like a big conspiracy theory, but believe me, I've got it all documented, and it's in a number of different books about Hughes. Robert Mayhew was close with Forsythe because Forsythe testified in a case that about the control of the Hughes Empire on behalf of Robert Mayhew. Robert Mayhew was the man, the ex-CIA agent, that Kennedy administration used to contact John Roselli and Sam Giancana of the Mafia to assassinate Fidel Castro. That's who Forsythe knew. And he knew Paul Laxalt, the former governor of Nevada. He testified to this. He testified under oath. So we think that either the FBI office out of Seattle or someone within the Hughes operation back in the 80s knew this murder was going to happen and put their guy there to watch it come down. And then when it went bad, when Selmy was able... See, if Selmy doesn't get out of the Union Hall, it's an unsolved murder, isn't it? Nobody's going to be able to figure out who did this.
Yes.
But Selmy named the hitman. So when the FBI informant was there, he saw this happen, he gets on the CB radio and calls his control agent and said, hey, you're not going to like this, but this guy just, you know... He just named the guys who shot him.
Well, so Mike, let me ask you a question. I'm curious about this. I mean, now that the case is basically done and you're running into this trouble writing the book, what have been the repercussions for you and for those involved in your organization? I mean, how has this affected your take on things and what you'd be willing to do now considering what happened? I mean, has it affected you negatively this way or? I mean, it would
be, honestly. No, it hasn't affected me negatively. Obviously, we had to keep under wraps. It wasn't just we were only worried about the Tulasan gangs. We were worried about Marcos agents. Marcos agents were at our demonstrations. They would take our pictures. When we filed the lawsuit against the Marcos government in September 1982, Marcos was here on a state visit to Ronald Reagan. And our investigator happened to be a Catholic priest. Bill Davis got Marcos served at the National Press Club. And boy, every time we went anywhere in D.C. after that, we were followed by these big bodybuilder types. But you know what? My personal safety is really of no concern because, sometimes you just got to buck it up and say, I don't really care. This is such an outrage that the Philippine government under Marcos could come in and murder my friends. Somebody was my best friend, murder these people in broad daylight, and then have the U.S. government, involved in covering this up is just unacceptable. Our government should be protecting us, not helping foreign dictators,
They don't seem to be helping people when it comes to Vladimir Putin, who seems to be pulling the same sort of thing, for instance, in the UK. What I'm wondering, too, is...
Don't you think?
You would think they
That's
would.
That's what I think. We had a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Eric Nalder, a great guy out of Seattle, say that what you just said. In this day and age when foreign governments are running, efforts to, affect our democratic processes... we can't stand when a dictator like Ferdinand Marcos or a Duterte, for instance, just imagine if Duterte decides he's going to send his agents into the U.S. to go after the international human rights lawyers, including myself, that are calling attention to the abuses there.
Mm-hmm.
And just think if the Trump administration supported that.
Have you heard of anything like that? I mean, this happened with Marcos, but you haven't heard of Duterte trying to influence anything in the United States.
Not yet, but we're very concerned about it.
I would think so, because the man is a dictator. There seems to be no doubt about it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so are you still actively involved in all of these organizations? I mean, are you still doing good work?
Yeah, well, I'm not. I mean, the anti-Marcos movement isn't still around, but the human rights movement still is. Sure, I'm involved in all of that. And
as a legal authority that's helping to resolve issues.
Yeah,
You are. Okay.
Well, the Public Justice Foundation is a national public interest law firm, and I was the former president of it. And they're very active in making sure that, you know, human rights are respected. And American Civil Liberties Union is obviously another group that I belong to that's also, you know, very active in protecting our civil liberties here.
And this murder, is there anything more you could tell about this? Because it's really pretty fascinating to me.
Well, I mean, there's one other story that'll blow your mind. So I mentioned that Ramil and Deloy were the trigger men in the decoy. Boyd Pillai ran across the street and gets into Tony Dictato's car. Well, Ramil, Deloy, and Dictato are all convicted of murder, but Pillai absconds. So we don't know where he is, but I heard he might be in Maryland. So I go back when we filed our lawsuit, and I was back in D.C. for a national press conference, and we filed a lawsuit, and I happened to be staying with a friend in Maryland, and I look up in the phone book, a guy named Dominguez living in Chevy Chase. Well, you know, that's Boyd Pillai's real last name. So I call the house and say, hey, is Boyd Pillai there? And his mom answers and says, no, he just left. Who's calling? So they had an arrest warrant for Pillai because he was implicated in these murders. But they didn't get him arrested in Maryland, but he comes back to Seattle, and I did a stakeout at the Bush Hotel looking down at the gambling houses where Pillai was known to frequent, and we had an informant inside the gambling houses, and sure enough, there's Pillai. So I get him arrested by the police department, right?
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I called up the detective, a great guy, John Boatman. I said, John, you want to arrest Pillai? He says, Where is he? Because he had solved the murder. You know, he was the main police officer for the Ramil and Deloy trial. He and Mike Tando, great, great homicide detectives. I have no beef with the Seattle Police Department. They were fantastic.
So then what happens is,
yeah, we have people in the Philippine community. They gave us a lot. They said, you know, Mike, we never would have made this case if you had not gotten Filipinos in the International District to come forward and talk to the police. They never would have talked to us. Because I told them, look, Gene and Selmy fought for you. They fought for housing for low-income people. They fought, you know, for parks for the International District. They fought against the regime in the Philippines. It's time you stepped up and go to the police and tell them what you know. And people came out of the woodwork.
Yeah,
so they give me a lot of credit for that.
Right? I mean, this yeah. would have been a big deal because once they go to the police, it's sort of a matter of public record. It could be. And then their lives could be in jeopardy, right?
They were free. Three of them had to have police protection going into the courtroom. They had the police had to sit with these witnesses because they, you know, people. This is a very intimidating murder, broad daylight, boom, boom, six shots of a .45 caliber execution piece. Forget about it. Anyway, back to Pillai. So Pillai gets arrested. We go to the prosecuting attorney's office and say, okay, great, you've got Pillai, charged Pillai with murder, and then turn him to testify against this Marcos ally who provided the gun and the money for the murder, right? That's how it works, right?
Yes.
Oh.
And I said,
yes.
I said to the prosecutor, Norm, if you let Pillai out of jail, he's a dead man. And they let him out of jail, and a month later, he had two bullet holes in his head. He was killed by a guy named Esteban Blong from the Philippines who had hundreds of dollars in his pocket. And he came here, he committed these murders, and he went back to the Philippines. So that hitman, that beat Pillai, the one guy that could have implicated the higher-ups, was snuffed out by the same people that killed Gene and Selmy.
So, Mike, let me kind of amend what you're saying there, and I sympathize with this absolutely because I work in law enforcement, and I am now a shift lieutenant in the corrections community. And
good for you. Thank you for your service.
Oh, thank
Seriously.
You, sir. And I agree with you. There are times where prosecutors or even the defense attorneys will say, don't let this person out of jail because we're working on something very sensitive. Now, that's a very difficult thing for us to do without a judge signing a detainer or, you know, we can kind of shift them around in the system 72 hours at a time. You're an attorney. I mean, you know exactly what I'm saying. But you're saying,
yes.
did you have a judge's order? I mean, how did they let this poor guy go knowing that he was going to be, you know, for all intents and purposes, assassinated again.
Well, it was crazy. I mean, what happened? Let me tell you what I think. And this is in my book. My suspicion is that when this guy Forsythe testifies, is an FBI informant coming in to testify under oath that somebody didn't even know who shot him, trying to exonerate the hitman, that the prosecuting attorneys got a little nervous. Because we're claiming that Marcos was involved. And of course, early on, we didn't have a whole lot of evidence. We eventually produced all that evidence of the intelligence slush fund and used to pay for it. But I think they got spooked. I think, you know, to charge Tony Barroso and Pili was kind of like, oh my gosh, that might lead up to the Marcos regime. And, you know, that's nothing that anybody wants to take on easily. Plus the fact Pili wasn't exactly a sterling witness against Barroso because he was a gangster, you know. So, but that's who you have to, you know better than I do. That's who you have to, sometimes you have to call people who aren't that savory. But in order to move up the chain, our strategy was to shake the tree of all the low-lying fruit, which were the hitmen, to go after the higher-ups. I mean, there's no full justice unless everyone who is involved, including those that were covering this up, are brought to justice.
So what do you think is the upshot right now? I mean, where does all this stand for you? I mean, what if you had to do a summary review of where it is right now and what's still outstanding, what isn't, what would you say?
Well, first, there's my book, Summary Execution, The Seattle Assassinations of Selma Domingo and Gene Varinas, tells this whole story. But part of it that isn't over yet is our recent discovery that this guy worked for the FBI office in Seattle. This wasn't just somebody who worked out in Southern California. He worked in Seattle. He was from this area, the FBI informant. So what we're going to do is say, hey, we want to report a crime. We want a crime investigator. We want the U.S. attorney in this jurisdiction to investigate this as a cover-up, as an obstruction of justice. Why is the FBI office helping the hitmen to kill American citizens at the behest of a foreign dictator? It's unacceptable. Our FBI can't be doing that. And they have to be transparent. So our big effort right now is to get those documents, 1,276 pages. Wouldn't you love to see those? Of course, if we get any of them, we still have, 3 years later, we don't have a single page.
I was going to ask you, what do you think, you personally think the odds are of getting this, of getting these papers?
I think we'll get, well, first of all, I think the FBI has got to give us some of the documents, but they're going to redact, they already told us that they're going to redact the name of the control agent. And we're going to say public interest outweighs the personal privacy of an FBI agent, the control agent that may even be dead, that therefore has no personal privacy issues. So we're going to fight that out. The FBI guy says, you're not going to get this guy. He says, you're not going to give it to him, but a judge may order it. So we'll file a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit to get the name of this guy. And then we'll try to find out if he's still alive and what he knows.
So, Mike,
I mean, that's, I thought this book was kind of like my bucket list of one, the culmination of my career. I'm retired. I write this book. Then all of a sudden, now in the middle of a further investigation into how the FBI put this guy at the scene of the crime.
Oh,
well, it looks like you have a sequel.
Yes, you should have known better. I mean, look at the conditions. Look at all the news today. Having said that, let me ask you this, because man, you've got me, and you said a word a little while ago that. Our usual host, Al Warren, he would chuckle at, but doggone it, I'm in charge today. You said the word conspiracy. So let me ask you this, because everything that you have said today points towards an absolute conspiracy. Have you filed a Freedom of Information Act on all of this? Everything you've said today, I'm sitting here thinking, freedom of information,
yes.
Freedom of information, freedom
yes.
of information.
Yeah.
Well,
first of all, we proved a conspiracy. The judge and the jury found that Marcos and all of these people engaged in a civil conspiracy. But the judge had already dismissed the U.S. government out because there wasn't any real theory of liability. Because we didn't know that this guy got run out of the Seattle office of the FBI, Forsythe. I've got 20 boxes of documents in my garage now of all the filings, everything. I would say probably 8 of them are Freedom of Information Act responses. A lot of redactions. A lot of stuff that we challenged and tried to win. But, you know, back in the 80s, it wasn't that easy to get good rulings.
Well, I understand the part about Marcos and the conspiracy, but I'm a little vague on the other part of it. Are you saying the FBI and our government is actively involved in the conspiracy? And if so, why? What would be the purpose of it? Is it was it at the time to protect the Marcos regime?
Great question. Mm-hmm. That's the essence of this issue, is what you just asked. So Marcos comes into power, freely elected, declares martial law, and gets the support of the United States government. And then under Carter, everything was kind of going south. The State Department really didn't like Marcos's human rights violation because they declared martial law. But Reagan, when he came in, promised to cooperate with the Marcos regime in going after the dissidents in the United States, believe it or not. We have this, I mean, this is in writing. And Marcos touts the fact he's got a new friend in the White House. So now the FBI and Navy thinks that they can go after these guys. I'm talking about the anti-Marcos organizations, including Gene and Selmy's group called the Union of Democratic Filipinos. That's where the conspiracy is. If you check this out. Naval Investigative Service had hundreds and hundreds of pages on the Union of Democratic Filipinos in their files. And in order to go after a domestic organization, the Navy, like any military, has to get an executive order signed by the president to infiltrate this group. They got it. They got an executive order allowing them to infiltrate the Union Democratic Filipinos with their agents, their spies, and their informants. And that's how they found out about Gene going to the Philippines.
Why are they so intent on shutting down these groups? I mean, they were dissidents.
Subic Bay, the big Navy base in the Philippines, was so important to the Navy that they didn't want this anti-Marcos group, you know, getting into the base, trying to talk servicemen into giving them supplies for, you know, for the new People's Army, giving them medical supplies. Didn't want any problems with with naval officers kind of deciding to be against the war in Vietnam back in the early 70s and then eventually to support Marcos. So, there were strategic reasons why the Navy was investigating it.
And would you say backfired because the subsequent presidents of the Philippines closed the base down? So was that like in response to what the U.S. government was doing? Or do you think
it was? Not really. I think they closed it down because they realized that U.S. dominance of their culture and their politics and their military wasn't really helpful. I mean, this is under Cory Aquino, you see. Marcos was overthrown. Once Marcos was overthrown, the U.S. military wasn't nearly as endearing to the Filipino people. They were just a Navy base and a, you know, Clark Air Base, and, you know, that wasn't any benefit to the Filipino people.
Well, actually, wasn't it one of their biggest sources of income at the time?
No, not really. Not, I mean, not because remember after the war in Vietnam, there was a step down. So by the 80s, you know, there's very little activity going on in those bases. And, that, you know, they kept them open through the 80s and then they basically shut them down. I think it was in the 90s.
Oh, see, because on the news, it was like because they were really strategic, big and, you know, a lot of employment for the local Filipinos and that
sure.
would be detrimental to them. But
remember all the base decommissioning? What's that?
I would think that that's a lot of employment, a lot of U.S. dollars, everything flooding into the area.
Well, in the 70s and 80s, yes, but not in the 90s. Yeah, because
Yeah, that's why I asked, because what I got at the time was from the news media, and you know how that can be. So actually what I heard most about was Imelda Marcos and her shoes. So.
Oh, touche.
You know, I took Imelda's deposition and I took Ferdinand Marcos's deposition. And the one question I never asked them was the shoes.
Oh.
The reason being is she was the power behind the throne. She was a dragon lady. This woman was vicious. She said, all the shoes, you know, she's kind of crazy. She's got all the shoes. No, no, no. Yeah, I mean, the stories go on and on about Imelda Marcos's, you know, treacherousness.
Did you personally take the depositions?
I took them both.
Oh, wow, that's impressive. Nice. So you met them.
You are the gift that keeps on giving.
Read the book. Hey, can I tell you a real quick story about the Marcos deposition? You guys will laugh. So it was on his veranda. It was in Hawaii. And we were intent. We had a videographer, and we were intent on the question and answer. And I asked him, "Could you explain to the jury why he declared martial law?" And Marcos goes, "Well, there was communists were bombing the buildings. There was chaos in the streets." And I said, "Well, okay, but in fact, under the Constitution of the Philippines of 1936, you were limited to 2 terms, weren't you?" And just when I asked this question, one of these indestructible flying Hawaiian cockroaches comes sailing through the windows and lands on Marcos's shoulder. Now, neither Marcos and I even noticed him because we're kind of intent on the question and answer, but the videographer was going, "What in the world?" And the cockroach was kind of, you know, looking at the camera going, "Hi, Mom." And so what happens is I said, he goes, "No, no, that's not true." And just then the cockroach like goes straight for Marcos's neck. It's like the cockroach's of truth is going to bite Marcos in the neck if he tells a lie, right? So his lawyers, Richard Hybe, his lawyer sees this cockroach and he knocks it off his shoulder, and Marcos, without missing a beat, looks at his lawyer and says, "Was that the wrong answer?" True story. We played his deposition to the jury. The jury just howled. "Oh, was that the wrong answer? Hold the phone. Was that the wrong answer?" Because, you know, he declared martial law because he couldn't run again. Communist in the streets. Come on.
Well, so Mike, what's coming up next? What's next for Mike?
Well, it's the big, huge commemoration of the lives of Selma Domingo and Jean Baroness book launch party next Tuesday, March 20th in Seattle, Washington. And we hope the governor, Jay Inslee, will stop by. Our congresswoman, Pramila Jayapal, has recorded a video. We've got people from the ACLU, state senate, people that were involved in the Committee for Justice. And I'll probably say a few words, and we're gonna sing the martyr song, which was by the Seattle Labor Corps, which was written right after the murders, you know. You know, we never said it would be easy. We never said we'd all see it through, but somehow we thought we'd be going on. We'd never be going on without you. You know, it's about Gene and Selmy. So there won't be many dry eyes, but that's going to be a big deal. And now with this FBI issue that was cropped up, we have a petition to the FBI saying we need you to give us these documents and to open an investigation into your role in sending your FBI informant to the scene of the murders. Isn't that exciting?
Yes, it is.
Am I blowing you guys' mind?
Making me laugh a lot, too.
Yeah. Well, you blew my mind in the first 5 minutes.
Because, it's amazing, really.
I mean, this story is just so full of twists and tangles. I have to ask, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask this. Now, we've talked a lot about the FBI today, and what is the CIA's involvement in this, in your opinion?
You know what? We hired a former military intelligence officer as an investigator. And the first thing, and to find out what U.S. intelligence had, and they basically got back to us and said this was a hit from the Philippines, mm-hmm. Look out for A, B, and C, bring a Freedom of Information Act request, that Viernes was carrying a large sum of money to the Philippines, which wasn't true. They had all this kind of documents on them, but the intelligence agent said, you know, the CIA wasn't involved, but Navy was, because Naval Intelligence does a lot of the dirty work for the CIA.
Well, of course.
When I interviewed a witness who knew this FBI informant, LeBain Forsythe, because Levain Forsythe tried to claim I was down there trying to call my architect. Well, what's your architect's name? Alex Bertulius. I go, okay. So I look up Alex Bertulius and I go see him. He's an architect down in Madison Park here in Seattle. And I said, Alex, so we have a friend in common. And who's that? Levain Forsythe. He looks at me and goes, oh, well, he's CIA. I go, what? Oh, yeah, he's a spook. So that, I mean, I didn't believe that. I don't think that's true. But what we were told was CIA wasn't involved, but Navy was.
Yeah, right. And you know what? I have to be a little bit jealous here because I'm Army. And why is it the Navy gets all the good assignments? they get
there might be a reason for that, Kevin.
I can't tell you how many times I said the same thing. I'm Army. My dad was Army. My two uncles were full bird colonels in the Air Force. And we're envious of the Navy. What can I say?
Yeah.
Well, the Navy's sort of noted for its intelligence, isn't it? I mean, I don't know much about the Marines or the Army by comparison. I mean, they have it.
Yeah,
it's always Navy intelligence you hear about, it seems like.
Well,
maybe they just have good, PR.
Or they're not.
Well, I don't know. I think it's
because they don't know how to stay secret. So there.
Spoken like a true Army man.
Well, there you go. Well, everybody, we've been talking to Michael today, and his book is Summary, Execution, The Seattle Assassinations of Silmé Domingo and Jean Viernes. Did I say that right?
You did.
And you like the accent there?
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is Viernes is Friday in Spanish and Domingo is Sunday, and the hitmen on their way in to kill him were reported to say, these guys are Sábado, Saturday, meaning they're not going to be anymore.
See? Now, you tell me that's not a conspiracy.
That's a conspiracy. Well, a judge and jury found a conspiracy. I don't even, I could just say, yeah, it's been proven.
But, Michael, now, in closing, we've only got a couple more minutes here. Can somebody, if they feel that they have information that may be, relevant to your research, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, the best way is to go on my website, www.michaelwithy.com. You can buy the book there. You can find out. Look, I've got all the resources, all the stuff I've been telling you. It's all on my website under resources. So just go on the website and shoot me or go on my Facebook page. It's called the Domingo and Viernes Story and shoot me a messenger and, look under Michael Withy and you can get a hold of me quite easily. My email address is mike@withylaw.com. If you have any information, that would be very, very helpful. Thank you.
And do you keep it secret? I mean, can the people do it anonymously, or can you do it with protection from you?
Sure, of course.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, no. I had to keep a lot of secrets. We had people that were really in fear of getting killed by the Tulisan gang that eventually ended up trusting us. But I got to say one other thing. This struggle for justice was impossible without the work of Terry Mass, the widow of Selmy Domingo, who confronted the guy, Baruso, who had her husband killed, Cindy Domingo, the sister of Selmy, and Barbara Viernes, the Committee for Justice for Domingo and Viernes. They're the true heroes of this story because they're the ones that drove the community to supporting the prosecution and our justice efforts when we, as we're bringing the civil suit. So I dedicate this book to Cindy and Terry.
Brave people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It sounds like to me like the people that were actually devastated by this occurrence actually went on to protect and defend the community that they, that they lived in.
At their own peril.
Absolutely.
Which is amazing. I mean, I'm not sure.
We all wore bulletproof vests. Believe me, it wasn't just me.
Yeah, I definitely would, I'll tell you.
Well, Michael, it's been an absolute honor to have you on the show today here on the House.
Oh, thanks.
And I thank you. Thank you for being so patient, and thank you for telling us your story of tragedy and, at the same time, inspiration as well.
In life,
tragedy and triumph.
And in life.
Hey, thanks so much. You guys were the best ever. I mean, I've been interviewed about the story. You guys are just great. So thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Mike.
Pardon me. Do you have any grape and pod?
All right, all right, all right.
Okay, now on the line we have Dr. Joe Usinski calling in for the Conspiracy Countdown. How you doing, Joe?
I'm doing great. Great to be with you, and I'm glad to hear that you're feeling better.
Yeah, getting there. Getting there. So what's new in the world?
So for this week, we are running into another conspiracy issue where we have Trump and we have the Parkland shooting still floating out there, and our conspiracy theorists out on the internet haven't moved past those two big ones yet. So I'm going to give a very special stylized countdown this week of the top movie conspiracy theories for the week. But before I do that, I do have a bonus for you. And there was one big conspiracy theory story that's just percolating through over the last 2 days. And that is that a D.C. council person came out and claimed because of the recent snowstorms that the Rothschilds control the weather. And they're making it snow on the East Coast right now.
Oh. Is there a reason that they're doing this?
Well, what a lot of people think is that it's because they're Jews and that this is just a thinly veiled anti-Jewish conspiracy theory. So what has happened since he said this is that the media outlets have found other instances of this council person engaging in conspiracy rhetoric. And apparently some of his donors to his political campaigns, who are Jewish groups, have educated him about the anti-Semitism of this Rothschild conspiracy, and he has since apologized.
Well, good.
But I will also say, it's, you know, anti-Jewish conspiracy theories are very popular. They have been popular for a long time. They're popular in Europe, too. But even more interesting are the weather control conspiracy theories.
Yeah, but that's been going on for years. I've heard about that since I was a kid.
It really goes back, you know, millennia. I mean, now we live these very nice sheltered lives where the weather only affects us, you know, in extreme circumstances like hurricanes, the tornadoes. Longer term trends like global warming, but go back, you know, to a time when we were subsistence farming. We didn't necessarily have conspiracy theories about the weather, but we had all these stories to explain why it rained or didn't rain, why the sun came up. So it all came down to the intentionality of some force, whether it was gods or devils or demons. If we sacrifice an animal or a human, it will make it rain. And now, you know, it's a dark force controls the snow. But I will tell you, I experienced it personally here in Florida right before the hurricane last fall, is that there, I was going through Target buying my supplies, my batteries and my water, and people in the checkout line were saying, Trump controls this. This is Trump's fault.
Oh, well, you know, you can't win. It's gone from the Nazis to the Jews to Trump, right?
So, and it is shocking. I mean, these weather events are very normal things. There's nothing out of the ordinary about a snowstorm in the Northeast, but you got to have somebody to blame.
Yeah, I guess you do. It makes you feel better. You can direct your anger toward someone.
Yes. So, our three movies for the week, and these are good ones, and I'm going to encourage people to find the accompanying videos on YouTube because these are fascinating. But number three, and I may have mentioned this on the program once before, and that is the Greece conspiracy theory. Hmm. And this is where people think that the entire plot of the Greece movie is actually Sandy's hallucinations as she drowns to death. If you remember the beginning of Greece, she's out in the ocean and she's drowning, and then the John Travolta character runs in and saves her.
Right.
The conspiracy theory is that the entire year at school, is just in her imagination as she's sinking and drowning and her brain is getting more and more erratic. And the evidence for this is that toward the end of the movie, if you watch it, it gets really crazy, right? Yeah. And they're saying that these are the thoughts of a dying person as they drown to death.
Okay.
So that's a dark one. So you'll never watch Speech the Same again.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But what's the conspiracy for? Like, why?
Like, well, they're using the term a little bit loose there to describe the fact that this is what they're insinuating the producers had in mind, but aren't telling anyone.
Oh.
So it's more of a secret than an evil plot.
Okay. I just thought maybe it was some liberal conspiracy, right?
No, it's that too.
Okay. That puts it right here. So good one.
Okay, so number two, moving up, is Star Wars, and there's two here. So one of the biggest movie series of all time, and one is a great video on YouTube, or actually a handful of them, that suggests that the most hated character, who isn't the Emperor or even Darth Vader, it's Jar Jar Binks from the prequels. They suggest he's actually the evil mastermind behind everything. So that's one. And the other one is that George Lucas is actually Luke Skywalker. Lucas Luke. You can see the connection there. Yeah. And that he is actually an alien from another planet, and this is his life story as Luke Skywalker.
Well, good. Good. I've always wanted to know. So we don't have to worry about who they are.
So whether you like the prequels or not, or if you like the Disney versions or not, just remember it's all true.
Oh, good. Yeah. So we have to change it to nonfiction.
Yes. And that goes the same for our number one movie conspiracy theory of the week, and that is Back to the Future actually predicts 9/11 and the Kennedy assassination, even though the movie came out 20-some-odd years after the Kennedy assassination, and we didn't know that it predicted 9/11 until 15 years after 9/11 happened. But nonetheless, the big piece of evidence for this is that Marty McFly goes to meet Doc Brown in the parking lot of the Twin Pines Mall, Twin Pines meaning Twin Towers, at 1:16 a.m. And if you turn it upside down, it actually says 9/11.
Oh.
So 1:16 upside down to 9/11. And then they're attacked by Middle Eastern terrorists, at which point he goes back to the future.
Oh. But I thought the Jews did it. Well, we've had several guests come on and say it was all Jewish.
Oh, my God. Well, the Back to the Future, Steven Spielberg says it was not the Jews, so...
Oh, so it's... Okay, so he's telling us how it is.
Yes, or he's in on it, so...
Yeah, let's say he's in on it. Unbelievable. Well, so that's the big countdown, and another great week.
Yeah, so I look forward to being back with you next week, and hopefully we'll have some new ideas from the fringe that I can share with everybody, and hopefully they won't be associated with Trump in any way.
Oh, good luck. Okay, thanks, Joe.
You're welcome.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
Has been completed.
The end! By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.